Hi, I'm Josh Braun, and this is the Inside Selling Podcast, a podcast about selling without selling your soul, where you'll learn how to become a better salesperson through the simple act of thinking like a buyer rather than a salesperson. Imagine that you've got a great corporate job, big salary, benefits, free snacks, but the job just doesn't feel good on your soul. Your boss is telling you he wants you to be a white circle in a sea of white circles, to follow the steps, to follow the rules. But in your heart of hearts, you know you're a red X. It just doesn't feel comfortable being a white circle. That's exactly how my guest Alex Grodnick felt when he left his high-paying six-figure financial services job to do his own thing and pursue his dreams as an entrepreneur. I love talking to this guy. He's got some great stories. Let's dive in. So take us back, man. How many years ago were you working the corporate gig? Was this 5 years ago? Was this 10 years ago?
This was just 4 years ago. Four short years ago with a stint in business school as two of those years.
So 4 years ago, you're in the corporate job and you're doing like financial planning, financial advising, financial services, something financial.
Finance, yeah. I was doing investment banking, which is your advising companies and investors in companies on how to buy companies, how to invest in companies, how to raise capital for those companies, debt and equity, IPOs. You see that? You see like now companies are talking about when they're going direct, what they're talking about is not using investment bankers to advise them, like what Slack and Spotify did and Slack wants to do. But usually investment bankers put themselves in the middle there and get paid tens of millions of dollars to tell companies how to do that.
Sounds like a great gig. You go to school for it and you're doing this for how long?
Yeah, I did it for about 6 years. And it's funny because, yeah, my whole life, I thought I knew that I wanted to be an investment banker. I don't know how that idea really got into my head. My entire family, my parents, their parents, my aunts, my uncles, everyone's entrepreneurs. And I guess it probably was my dad kind of glamorizing the life of working at a big company because he never did that. And my parents would say things like, oh, you get job security and they teach you things and you get training and one day they'll buy you a country club. And I'm like, Mom, I don't think it works like that anymore. But so they were kind of glamorizing the life that they never had. And so I was like, okay, I'll go get the hardest to get, most prestigious job out there, kind of the top of the financial system, investment banking, go work on Wall Street, work 100-hour weeks, get paid, you know, over $100,000 my first year out of college, go do that. And so that's what I did. I mean, there were definitely some twists and turns. I got the job in 2009, like in the middle of the financial crisis, not so easy, but made it work, worked lots and lots and lots of hours, got a good skill set. But I mean, I wish it happened faster, but it took 6 years for me to realize this wasn't for me.
Let's slow that down a little bit. So it's 2009, you've worked really hard to get this job. Your parents glamorize it. You want to make a bunch of money. It's 2009. When did you have the first thought that this might not be right for you? I mean, you start in 2009. Was it like a month later? Was it 2 years? Take us back if you can remember where you started to have that first thought that this just isn't feeling right on the soul.
No, it wasn't for years. And the reason is because I got this job when I was 22 years old. Basically for the first 22 years of my life, this is what I planned on doing. And so when I was able to get that job in the middle of the crisis, when none of my friends were able to get jobs, I was just elated. I mean, I can remember when I got that phone call and I was jumping up and down in my friend's house and getting the signing bonus and going to New York for training and living in a hotel. And like, I mean, it was just so sexy and so cool that it took, I mean, Josh, like I said, I wish it happened quicker, but it took years and years before I realized that, hey, like, this isn't for me.
When did you realize that? So 2009, you start the job. And I know this is a long time ago. Maybe you don't remember. Was it like 2010 where you had the first thought that maybe this isn't for me? Because it wasn't on day one, right? On day one, you're elated. This is awesome. I've worked hard to get this. How many years in? Was it months in? Was it days in? Was it hours in?
No, it was like 4 or 5 years in. And because I got caught up in the grind and like figuring out how to rise up in that job and how to get a better job and how to, you know, move out from New York to Los Angeles. I wanted to do that. And I got my company to transfer me and then I got a different position and I got a promotion. And so your mind only has enough capacity for so many things. I wasn't thinking, oh, entrepreneurship time. I was just thinking about how to make the most out of what this, the opportunity that I had in front of me. And that's all my mind was doing.
I get it. But then something happened in 2013. So now we're 4 years in, you're making good money, you're doing what you're told to do. And then something happens in 2013. I want to go to that first thought. Do you remember where you were? I know this is going back to 2013, but I want to go back to this moment. Can you take us back there? Like we're making a documentary and we're filming Alex's life. Where was that? Was it at night? Was it a day? Take us back.
Yeah, it was. I mean, everything in investment banking happens late at night. You're working till 2 a.m. all the time. So yeah, I was in my boss's office and I was an analyst. And the role of an analyst is a very, very defined role, obligations. You build financial models and you build PowerPoint presentations to put those financial models into and to show to clients. And like, that's it. You get direction from the top down and they say, hey, Alex, you're going to do this and you're going to do this and you're going to do it like this. And I was always saying, oh, well, what if we did it like that? Or what if I had applied this approach? Or what if we showed it like this? And those ideas were always getting shot down. And I remember how many days, multiple days, all nighters working on something. And I kind of put an Alex type twist on it and it just got ripped apart by my boss, you know, late at night. And
was it getting ripped apart because of the idea or that you weren't following the rules? They couldn't like see, this is how we do things here. And why are you not doing things here? Or were they looking beyond that and saying, you know, this idea that you did was terrible. What was your perspective on that?
No, it really wasn't a radical idea, Josh. I mean, it's pretty boilerplate stuff, but yes, they have their formula of how things work and how the presentations need to look and fine. It's a successful company. I was working for JP Morgan. It's been around for 200 years. And then another company called Houlihan Lokey that makes, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. So these guys people are driving Ferraris. And so the formula works. So like why tamper with it? Right. But my brain always tried to poke holes and always tried to tamper in it. And I saw my friends and they were like happy just doing, you know, staying in the middle of the fairway, doing what they were supposed to be doing. And I was never happy with that. But like I said, I didn't question it. I was just like, oh, that's who I am. But you know, after so many times of doing this, yeah, I remember this one night, it was just trying to fit that square peg into the round hole for the, you know, 10 millionth time that finally it was the straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, how many analogies, cliches can I fit into that sentence? But it just happened where I said, what's happening here? I don't even like this. Yes, I like the money. Yes, I like feeling really important and telling people that I'm an investment banker and, you know, feel like all those kind of ego type things that come along with the job. But I just said, this is not for me. But that was the thing. I said, it's not for me, but I had no clue what was right for me. Right. I mean, 25 years of my life was all spent towards a singular task. So now what do you do? That's like the real question.
What's interesting too is when you first started in 2009, you were putting circles into circles. And then in 2010 or 2011, is that when you started to try to put circles into squares? It sounds like you've done this 3 or 4 times. You kind of finally got fed up with it in 2013. But I'm interested as to when that started, because in 2009, you were fine putting circles into circles. And then there was a point before 2013 where you were like, I'm going to try putting a circle into a square. Do you remember that moment?
Yeah, I mean, it was, Josh, always circles into squares. I mean, I was never doing the right things. I always had clashes with coworkers and bosses, and people were always telling me, do it like this and do it like that. And you know, sometimes it worked, and sometimes there were like great outcomes, and people were like, oh, wow, like, who is this, like, you know, 22-year-old that's changing the way things are done and interesting, you know, tidbits like that. But that was rare. Most of the time, it was always like swimming upstream. So, but I didn't care. I didn't know any different, right? I mean, my first job, like I'm thinking, oh, everyone like has struggling with their jobs, but that's not the case. Like everyone doesn't struggle with their job. Some people just love being a cog in an organization and getting told what to do. And that's just, but I didn't know any better, right? I'm making money and I'm like going fast and learning. And so like, it was fine. You're content with all the things that you do have.
Yeah, until you weren't, right? And so in 2013, something started to tip out of balance. So you've had a lot of these experiences, it sounds like multiple times, of trying to be creative in your job and being told, essentially, we don't value creativity. Didn't start to feel good on your soul. In 2013, you mentioned the straw. I would imagine this happened a couple times. This last time in particular you mentioned was the straw. What was it about this last time that finally did it?
Well, Josh, you layer on working in a really, really intense place. I mean, not everyone has to put up with working, you know, 80, 90, 100 hour weeks, and, you know, getting yelled at, like yelled at all the time. I mean, one time this wasn't directed at me, but like we had a glass door in our office, and one of the associates, they're like the managers of the analysts, walked out and slammed the door so hard that the glass shattered on the door. I mean, like, that's the type of culture. I mean, it's a high intensity. It's pretend high intensity, right? Like, we're not saving lives. We're advising companies and bondholders on how to make a few extra $1 million. So yeah, it's interesting work, but people take it very, very, very seriously. And that was the other thing. I always thought there was something wrong with me that I didn't take the job seriously. Like, I liked it. I liked learning, and I liked, you know, working there, the things I said I liked doing, but I was never like going to devote my life to it, which almost everyone I worked with did. And I had a really tough time doing that. So when you layer on the fact that you haven't slept for months and months, you're getting yelled at, this is late at night, you know, you probably had like shitload of candy and a lot of Cokes that day. It's like, it all kind of just piles up to saying like, what's happening here? This is not right.
So take us through now. So now that it's been piling up and you've worked all this time, you're making a lot of good money. So there's obviously a pull to keep you there. There's also a habit to keep you there, but then there's something pulling you, I should say, away from it. We talk about this in jobs to be done theory. When we switch, we always see like there's a pull pulling me towards something, and then there's a push pushing me toward it. So talk to us a little bit about what was pulling you away from the corporate job in 2013.
Yeah. So, that's what I was saying is the hard part. Cause yeah, I was getting pulled away, but I wasn't getting pulled towards anything. I was just getting said, this is not right, but I have no idea what is right. But I can tell you, like I said, I was a born entrepreneur. Everyone in my family was entrepreneurs. Growing up, I was the lemonade stand kid selling magazines door to door, starting car washes. I started a taxi service during the Sundance Film Festival. I grew up in Park City, Utah. So just startup after startup. And in investment banking, though, you can imagine that creativity kind of gets beaten out of you. So I went, not like I was having these great ideas anymore. I was just spending all my time trying to rise up the corporate world and work hard and play that game. And so I knew I didn't have the idea, but I knew that like this wasn't right. I couldn't stay here any longer. So I actually left without even having a job. I just said, I can't do this anymore. I got the bonus. I mean, you get big bonuses, and a lot of people kind of leave after the bonuses. A lot of people go have something lined up. Some people don't have stuff lined up. I didn't have anything lined up, but I did asked my now wife to marry me on the day that I quit. Cause like I asked her father, I don't know, 5 or 6 months before this, but I was never able to like plan a dinner while I was working. So I said, okay, I'm quitting. I'm getting engaged. That's what's happening. And I'll figure the rest out.
Quit the job. Ask the girl to get married. Love it. You know, I want to go back to something you said, because it's such an amazing story and it really speaks to your entrepreneurial spirit. It's one of the best stories I've ever heard. And this is the story about you spinning up a taxi cab service in Utah when you saw demand. This is such a great story, especially, well, I don't want to ruin it, but let's take us back to it, because I love the story and I know my viewers have probably not heard it before. So you're in Utah and people are flooding in because it's vacation time and you're seeing demand for cars that are not there.
Well, yeah. So I grew up in a small ski town, Park City. I think it's like 10,000 full-time people, not a lot. In the wintertime, sometimes there can be close to 1 million people there. You can't even get like a cell phone line when you try to dial out. So it's like a small town had built for much, much, much more. But there's a time during Sundance Film Festival, which actually happened, I think it's like the end of January, beginning of the last couple weeks of January, usually. And basically all of Hollywood, all these movie stars, all this film business comes to Park City. And this was when I was in high school, and this was way, way, way before Uber. There was like a few yellow cabs in my town, but basically there was nothing. And I wish I could remember the light bulb moment, but I just said like, how are people getting around? Like, I remember I saw like, there's like a free bus system in town. The buses were always jam packed. People rented cars, but it's just basically there's way too many people in way too small of town. So something like that was necessary. And so all that I did was I took my mom's, old Lexus SUV, and I put, taxi. I went and bought these like fluorescent letters from Home Depot. I put taxi on it. And this is the funny part. My dad actually did some work with the with a police organization earlier in his career. And so he had one of those like police lights that like, you know, an undercover cop slaps on the, on their roof. This was like an official one. It was like red and it's fun. So what I'm like, you know, 17 years old. I put this thing light on where I'm driving the car, and Josh literally like for the first 6 hours, I don't think I didn't have someone in my car. And then when the very first person I gave them, you know, the ride, I got flagged down. I'm like, oh great. I took them somewhere 5 minutes away. And I said, how much do I owe you? And I kind of froze, 'cause I was like, oh, I didn't even think about how I was going to make. And I said, just, you know, just give me a tip. Like that just seems simple. $20, boom, right there for five minute drive. And I was like, okay, wow. And before they even close the door, someone else is getting in the car. So for like 6 hours straight, I'm just driving, like celebrities, Hollywood people. I mean, all sorts of fun, interesting stories of people that got in the car. And I went home, I think like 11 o'clock that night. And I walked into my brother's room, my younger brother. He was probably like 14 at the time. And I just poured money on the ground, you know, like Richie Rich. And I'm like, Jake, like I'm just like pouring like a $500 on the ground right here. I'm like, this is pretty great. And I'm giving people my phone number. My phone's ringing at 2 a.m. And I just did this for like 2 straight weeks. And I got a couple of my buddies into it, and they're driving. But, also I got into a little bit of trouble with saying taxi. You know, I didn't feel like I had a business license or anything, but I think this is kind of like the hallmark of an entrepreneur. Like you just kind of go and ask for forgiveness later. I mean, look what Uber did. This is long, long, long before Uber, but now Uber brings cars to Park City for Sundance. But when they first started, they didn't have all the regulations and everything figured out. They just kind of did it. So yeah, I got pulled over on the side of like the main road in my town, Main Street, with this light, you know, blinding thousands of people as I'm going down, and there's cops all around me. And they're like, kid, who are you? Like, you live here? Like, what the hell are you doing, basically? And where'd you get this light? And like, just, so they like pulled me out of the car. And basically, by the end of it, they were just like, you know what? Just go home. Like, just stop. And I'm going home. And I'm like, well, there's no way that I can stop this. So I took down the light. I put free rides taxi, because I said, oh, I'm not charging. Again, pulled over. They had a problem with the word taxi. So fine, I got rid of the taxi and free rides. And I got pulled over a third time. And basically they were like, yeah, you've beat the system. You're good to go. If you just drive around saying free rides and you're working off tips. And so, yeah, I think I did that. Yeah. For that year of Sundance. And then I went to college the next year. But that was me. I was just thinking of stuff like that left and right. And then my time in investment banking, no ideas, creativity dried up. And so I thought I gotta get back to who I my authentic self here.
It's such a great story, because so many entrepreneurs that I speak with start with the product, and then they'll call me and they'll say, "How do I sell this thing?" And I'm like, "Well, what problem do you solve? How do you make people better?" And like, I don't know. I just built this thing. But I think what was great about the story is you just were living your life, man, and you saw this observation, and you didn't do an MVP. You didn't think about it for 7 hours. You didn't have a marketing plan. You didn't talk to 20,000 investors. You're just like, hey, I'm going to get in the car. I'm going to go do this thing. And then when you were told to stop, I think most people, and myself, I'll include myself in this bucket, cops pull me over. I'm going in my room and I'm under the covers and I'm never coming out. But it was interesting. Your thought process there was, what's the problem really? It's not really with the driving. You kind of isolated it to this word taxi, and you were able to solve the problem in a very unique way. And it turns out that free was actually better, because the tips probably exceeded the fare at the end of the day.
Yeah, you're right. I don't, you know, now that I look at what my skill set is, yes, I've got some training from finance and I can build financial models and that sort of thing. And people value that. But really what I say that my skill set is I'm good at kicking down doors. I just don't take no for an answer. When I hear no, my brain starts to work and starts, the gears start to go. And I love coming up with creative solutions to get around no's. And that definitely, comes from my father, who always just said, you know, just like never take no for an answer.
Yeah. Are there times though to take no for an answer?
I mean, obviously, like, of course, but just like what I'm telling you, my times in my work in investment banking, I would get told a certain way to do things, and I always wanted to go do it the other way. So I don't know where that comes from, you know, like defying, you know, leadership or whatever it is. You know, maybe I have some kind of interesting relationship with my parents. but yeah, like I hear no, and instantly my brain starts to go. And yeah, like, this is a lot to my wife's dismay. Like, she hates it. She's always like, Alex, just like, do what you're told. Stop like always trying to beat the system. Josh, I love beating the system. I get such pleasure from doing it, and so much fulfillment from finding like a way to some kind of creative way that's like, you know, borderline, like kind of like skirting the system.
What's another thing that you've done to beat the system? I'm sure you got a bunch of stories, but does another one pop out at you where you quote unquote beat the system?
Just so many, but I can tell you that the issue with it is the rush, you know, the adrenaline that you get from it and the, you know, fulfillment is very, very, very short lived. So even now, like when I'll be driving and I'll like get through a yellow light, right? And it's like, oh yeah, that's like it's like a little high. But how long does that last? It's literally lasts like a split second. And then that very next yellow light, if I don't get through that, I'm like pissed off. Like I have to get through the next one, So it's not really like an easy way to go through life, because I'm always, always looking for some kind of like angle. So you got to find like a more intrinsic way to like just get, be happy with your, it's probably because, you know, I'm not happy with my situation.
I get it. So when you leave this job, back forward in the timeline, you leave this, it's a little fearful. Like, I know myself, when I left the corporate world, and I think a lot of people have aspirations to leave, but there's fear, right? I lack confidence. Maybe I have a family. Maybe I have bills. I know you had gotten a good payday, so maybe you had a little bit of a buffer, but still, it's not endless. I mean, eventually you have to, you know, bills to pay. Talk to us a little bit about that and your perspective on how you dealt with that as you left, especially where you weren't jumping into anything new. You didn't have a idea for a company. You just knew that you just couldn't take it anymore. And I think people get to that point, but they're like, I have to stay here because I can't leave without a plan. And you left without a plan.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people are wondering like, hey, I know you had some money. I have some money squirreled away too, but still there's this fear of running out. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yep. The better way to do it is to, you know, leave with a plan and have like, you know, one foot in both, and like, don't leave your job until you have, like you said, a minimum viable product or some kind of just the business de-risked to enough of a far enough point that you can say, oh, there's like something here. I can jump in both feet. That's much, much, much better way to do it. My situation was so extreme that like, I couldn't even have a single second to work on anything else. And yeah, I left and I didn't know what the hell I was going to be doing. And so when I left and I like took a week off and I went with a buddy and we went to, you know, a lake in Arizona and we had fun. But I came home and I'm like, okay, what now? And so I basically just jumped back on the path that I was on, just not at that company. I started doing like consulting financial type work for companies, basically just like a one man investment bank. I started applying for jobs that people were looking for that investment banking skill set. I'm like, still, that's all I knew, right? I didn't know any different. So thankfully,
even though you didn't want to do that, you're now applying, like you left that and now you're, seems like you're getting back to that. What's that about?
Well, I was looking for like a little bit more of a balanced type life than what I had there. And so some of these jobs, you know, they obviously wouldn't pay quite as much, but they would use that. Cause Josh, I like basically killed myself to get that training, that skill set. And so I was like a notch in my belt. I'm like, I'm proud of this skill set. So how can I go apply that in a field or a opportunity where there's just a little bit more
balance? Yeah.
So that was the plan. And I landed at this digital media company, startup, whatever you want to call it, here in Santa Monica. And you know, they hired me for the investment banking skill set, but the company was such a mess organizationally that I got to do a lot of my kicking down doors stuff, which I wasn't able to put words on that yet. So that's where I was able to kind of figure out, oh, hey, look, I'm doing these, kind of this job has two parts, the finance valuation type part, but then also the like just figuring out how to do things part. I like that second half of it much, much, much more. So now let's go find a job where it's much, much more of that. How do I do that? Still no clue. Business school was something it was always in the back of my head. And like, I was able to do that kind of one foot in, one foot out kind of thing at this job. I had time to study for the GMAT. I had time to apply to business schools. I worked at this job like till the Sunday before business school started. So it was all just like a very, like a more seamless transition this next time.
Now, when you say knocking down doors, is this like prospecting for business? Is this, how are you defining knocking down doors, just for clarity?
Yeah, so this company owned a portfolio of content websites. They made websites for, they had a celebrity gossip one. They had like a one that had kind of like raunchy content for guys. It actually did really well on Facebook. They had like a mom's website, a pet website. Anyways, they had all these websites, but some of them made money, some of them didn't. They had no clue how to make money. So on the day one, my boss, who was the CFO there, said, "Alex, figure out how our websites can make more money." I'm like, "The hell are you talking about? Like, you need to give me more." I'm like, "I'm used to like getting told exactly what to do." And it's like, "Yeah, I don't know. Just like go compare them, look at them, see what's good, what's not good. If we should buy new websites, if we should sell websites." So it was like the broadest mandate ever, right? And so I mean, that transition period of like leaving a job where you're told exactly what to do versus getting a job where you have very, very, very little direction. And then the CFO ended up leaving and I had no boss, and there's a whole nother story. But so I was basically tasked with building businesses.
So how did you do that? So you took this websites, there was some content websites. And when you say, knocking down doors, meaning figuring out how to monetize it.
And we get opportunities all the time to like buy new websites. Sometimes people would offer to buy our websites. So we ended up like, very early on, we ended up buying the movie phone website, and we kind of like structured this like joint venture with AOL. And then it was like, all right, well, what do we turn this thing into? And what other, like, look at the comps, what other businesses are there? Like, what are the ways we could generate revenue on this? Oh, let's build it into the TV guide of the internet. You can type in a show and it'll tell you where to watch it. That's something interesting.
So it was more like biz strategy rather than like cold outbound prospecting and cold calling. It was more like strategy partnerships, that kind of thing.
Yeah. There wasn't really a sales component to that job. I like that sales component. That job didn't have it.
So you left that. You like doing that sort of work more than being put in the box. What happens next?
So now it's time for business school. And, like I said, it was always something I wanted to do. It's 2 years. It's basically like the most selfish 2 years you can take in your life, because you're going to something, you're paying money, and you're basically saying, what do I want to do with my life? How do I like look in? How do I have incredible experiences? How do I meet new people? How do I figure out what I want to do with my life? And so you go take this really, really selfish 2 year time. I got to do it in LA. I went to UCLA, so I didn't have to move or anything. It's pretty simple. And it was there where I was really able to come up with a very clearly defined value proposition of what I'm good at, what I want to be doing, and what I need to be doing in my life.
When was that? How far into college was that? Was that you were a year into the program, 6 months into the program?
In Q2. So, somewhere between 4 and 6 months.
So take us back to that moment.
Yeah.
Like, so how did you find that out? School, what was it?
Yeah. For business school, most people, like, they have these kind of moments. There's a lot of travel. There's like a lot of like going out and drinking and networking and partying and having fun. Unfortunately, my moment didn't happen on like the top of a mountain in Peru. It happened at like 8:30 in the morning in a leadership, I don't remember the title of the class. It was like communication leadership, something like that. And the professor was kind of like a touchy-feely kind of guy. Most of the classes you take in business school, like statistics, finance, like hardcore stuff. This was a class, I've already taken a lot of those classes, so this was something that I was excited for. And the professor said, "I want you to write down times when you feel like you're being your authentic self." And he defined authentic self as feeling like you're really just using all of your brain, firing in all cylinders, kind of, really feeling good about yourself. So fine, I'm like writing down some times. And then now it's like, okay, now like look at, I think I wrote down 4 or 5. He's like, all right, now I'm like, let's analyze this. And I'm looking at it. I'm like, oh my God, every single one of these, I was doing one of those entrepreneurial things I was doing as a kid. I had this thing where I was buying people's lift tickets after they were done skiing, and then like turning around and like reselling them at the bottom of the ski mountain, and not even buying, people were just giving me their tickets and I was turning around and selling them. And so I'm looking at all those things. I'm like, oh, wow, clearly that's what I'm good at, is just coming up with these, random little businesses and thinking of them. And that's when I'm my authentic self and I'm smiling and feeling powerful and good. And say, okay, very, very easy light bulb moment. I need to be doing something entrepreneurial. I need to do a startup. And cause like, you know, when I came to business school, I was like, oh, I'll come and I'll like repackage myself and I'll go get one of these really prestigious jobs at a hedge fund, or I'll work for a film studio. And I was like, okay, those dreams are over. Like, that's not what I need to be doing at all. But again,
you at that point drop out of school and start being an entrepreneur, or you finish it up?
No. I mean, school these days, like business school is still the best. If you want to go get a job at a big company, that's what it's geared for. But it's, if you like, there's a lot of resources there to, I started two businesses while I was in school. There's just like a lot of resources to kind of get your mind thinking in an entrepreneurial way, which I needed because I've been removed from it for
since we were like 15, right?
Yeah, I didn't know how to. I was like, okay, I need to start a business. That was scary to me. I knew I could always go get one of these jobs that like would pay me money to build financial models. But starting a business, I was like, oh wow, I don't even know where to start with that.
So where did you start?
I started with a podcast because I was having all these incredible meetings through business school with CEOs and founders and start. I mean, basically business school, you have this .edu email address and it's a free calling card to email whomever you want and just grab a coffee. So I'm meeting with the most interesting people around Los Angeles, driving around stuck in traffic, as you mentioned, and listening to podcasts. And I thought, hey, I could start a podcast and I can get practice starting a little business. So literally same kind of thing as the taxi. I had no clue what I'm doing. I bought a couple of microphones on Amazon and I start emailing people saying, hey, do you want to be on my podcast? And like right away I got the CEO of Warner Brothers. I had the CEO of Hulu, like big time people.
What was the ask? It was like, hey, I'm a college student and come on my podcast. What was the sort of pitch?
Basically, yeah. I'm like, yeah. Hey, I'm getting my MBA. I'm like, here's my background. I've done some interesting things. I'm trying to like just do this now. I've started this little podcast and what do you think? And yeah, you're going to get no's, but you get way less no's when you're sending it from a student perspective.
You know, I did a volunteer class at the University of South Carolina and everyone was asking, you know, how do I get my first job? Where do I apply, you know, sales job? And one of the things that I talked about is just this exact approach, which is it's never been easier to start. You don't even need a podcast. You could do what we're doing right now, which is a LinkedIn video. You can have your own show. Congratulations. You have your own TV show. You can reach out to sales professionals, VPs of sales, and interview them about the job. And most people are open to talking about what they do and how they lead teams. And from there, you can start to understand what their needs are and potentially have a relationship that can lead to something. But I, like you, like a big believer, the more conversations you have with people, the more reach you have, the more opportunity you have. And so it's not just about sending your cover letter in for a resume. You can actually start to create your own opportunities while you're in school. And it doesn't have to be this traditional wait to graduate to start sending a resume out. I love that, Alex.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. So the podcast took off. It's got lots of listeners and everyone likes to listen to it now and stuff. But basically, it's provided an added benefit because instead of just saying, hey, here's my resume, here's my cover letter, whatever it is, like, can I have a job? I'm not talking about jobs. Yeah, my end goal was to like find opportunities and things like that. But all I'm leading with is, hey, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about yourself for 30 minutes, which Josh, every single human wants that. I mean,
who does not want to be acknowledged?
Yes.
I mean, that is the core, Stephen Covey, man, Seven Habits. Who does not want to be acknowledged? I just a quick sidebar because it's so important. I was in the local seafood market one day, waiting in line, got to the front, asked the guy working there how to prepare swordfish. This guy spent 10 or 15 minutes with me showing me different seasonings. He brought some out from the back. I said, let me talk to your manager. He's like, did I do something wrong? I go, no, I want to tell him what an awesome job you did, and gave him compliments in front of the manager. And you should have seen this guy. Every time I go into that fish market now, this guy, Josh, come on in, man. I got this new thing. It is the best, greatest thing you could do is to acknowledge people and be genuinely, not in a fake way, because as you said, Alex, because you're intended to get a job, but in a curious way, because I bet, Alex, and I'll ask you, I bet you found these people pretty interesting. I mean, they sound like successful people. You probably learned a ton.
Yeah. I mean, that authentic approach is everything. If you can be genuinely interested in someone else, like you did with the fish guy, like the dividends that's going to pay back to you in your life, but you can't do it for the secondary reason. You have to do it because like you're genuinely interested. And when you hear about the best leaders in the world, the Steve Jobs, the Nelson Mandelas, when you read these things about when they spoke with someone, they made it feel like you were the only person in the world, versus now you speak with someone and they're like, you know, they're on their phone and like, they're like, you're not even paying attention to me, versus when I'm speaking with Steve Jobs and he's giving me his undivided attention. It's a different type of trait that some people have, or I mean, you can develop it for yourself as well.
We could certainly do a whole other podcast on this, but guys, everyone knows you're not listening when you're on a call. Everyone knows. You think you're faking it. I've actually had people on my podcast while I was interviewing them and they were multitasking. Like you could always tell, people always know. If someone comes into your office, shut the laptop down, turn the phone, how about this? Instead of turning the phone over on the table, why not just take the phone off the table and be there? And it's super tough today, man, because I think our brains are always thinking like, what are we gonna say next? And it's a super great skill, man. It's in Think and Grow Rich. It's in Seven Habits. It's in all the great books. If you can be genuinely curious, but not from a, and this is a really important point you made, not from a I'm doing this because perspective. And I think, so did you pick people that you were genuinely interested in speaking with? I would imagine you did.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in the beginning I was like, oh, who can I get the biggest, most important person? But then I was like, all right, these big interviews are not even that great. Let's just go to people that I'm interested in hearing their story. And now like I do that 30 minutes. It's an interesting story. Listeners find it valuable, but now we feel like we have a really authentic one-to-one connection. This person's like, we're friends now. We're inviting me to their house for dinner. It's like, it's a really cool way to go about it. And like you said, everyone can have a podcast or a blog or a Facebook video, whatever you want to do is like your hook, but find some way to like get your foot in the door. That's not just asking for a job. Maybe it's like providing value in some way. The podcast is providing value, by the way. You find some way to provide value that's not just saying, hey, give me a job.
Yeah. So guys, so about my business. So when I first started, I'm a sales consultant and trainer. So outreach.io is a sales tool. It doesn't matter what it does. I wanted to train their reps to be better on cold calls. I could have done the usual sales consultant thing and made a cold call to do some version of I'm going to help your reps get better on the phone so they can book more meetings. But I didn't. I reached out to Mark Kozaglow and I said, hey, I'm spinning up a podcast interviewing sales leaders. Would love your take on how you lead high growth teams. And within, I don't know, I want to say 4 minutes, I got a response back. Sure, man. And we were jamming. We've had two or three podcasts that led to four webinars that we've done together. It's been the biggest source of leads that I've converted for my business, but I didn't set out. That wasn't my intent at the beginning. It sort of just naturally grew to that. And I think if you don't go in with that intent and you just go in to learn and be curious, those kind of things happen. They just happen. And the more conversations you have, the more reach, the more those things happen. I think it's great, Alex. Awesome. Awesome idea.
Yeah, and look, I get to speak with interesting people. I get to speak with people like you and founders and startups and investors. I mean, it's a pretty cool little job I get to have.
All right, but you didn't stop there. Now we go on to venture number two.
Yeah, so I'm doing this. I'm having all these interesting meetings and calls, and it's going well. The podcast is growing. And when I was finishing business school, I thought, okay, maybe there's something more with the podcast. Like I know how to create a little podcast now. I've got like some business expertise. Maybe I can get brands to hire me to have them to build them podcasts or podcasting strategies or whatever it is. And so I actually did a few of those. I built little podcast efforts for UCLA's business school, actually a couple other like venture capital type funds. And as I was doing it, I was at a startup event and I met my now co-founder and he was telling me about a fintech business he was building. And I said, this is awesome. And he was like, yes, I want two things. I want a finance person and I want a hustler. And I'm like, what am I? I was like, wow, you're telling me exactly, you're describing me right now. So it wasn't, and Josh, like it wasn't like, okay, like let's sign a contract and you'll do this. I mean, probably worked for like, you know, 2 or 3 months, like still while I was finishing up business school, just for like nothing, just providing value, helping them get things off the ground, build financial models, think about their investment, think about how to get investors, think about their business plan. And after I provided 3 months of value, it's like, okay, now there's like, this is a good fit. Let's like solidify this. Let's sign papers and let's get it going. And even since then, my equity has increased like 5 times. Like now I'm like a full co-founder. I have like a lot of equity, but in the beginning I didn't have those things. But I didn't like let that limit, like if I was going to do this or not. I was passionate about the opportunity and I thought I could add value.
So sidebar again, guys. So this is another theme that I hear all the time when I talk to people like Alex, right? So Mark Kozaglow over at Outreach, big company now, but when he started, he said, no salary, man. I'll just go on performance. Whenever I sell something, I'll take a cut. Sarah Grotz, when she was at Syracuse, the way in which she landed her job at Banff was to figure out what the CEO wanted. At the time, he wanted to get interviews for his book with CEOs. And she figured out how to go and line those things up. And he hired her for these little projects. It's exactly what you're talking about, is you don't need permission. You don't need to apply. You can actually start doing stuff. The agency that I used to work with, when I was looking to hire an agency for a project, we interviewed three agencies. Two of them gave us a bid and a deck and all that stuff. The third agency, which was founded by this guy, Harry Gottlieb, said, hey, we actually started the project. Here's a taste of the work. Let us know if you want to talk. And literally it was a link to some work. And we were like, we passed it around. We're like, oh my God, this is freaking amazing. He got started while everyone else was starting to pitch. And they were, I don't know, 25 or 30% more. And we ended up hiring him. That's the idea here, is that when we talk about getting started, it's super powerful.
Yeah. You know, I have a ton of venture capitalists on my podcast now, because I'm raising money from venture capitalists. So I want to have them on and talk to them and hear their strategies and how they got to where they are. And maybe one of them will give me money, which they already are starting to. But people ask me all the time, saying, oh, how do I become a venture capitalist? Well, what's the job of a VC? They're like, their job is to like go source new companies and like help those companies grow. So if like you can provide some of the background of like, hey, look, I just met an interesting company, and you can help give them deal flow. The same thing with any industry. You can help them with their job before you have the job. You don't have to like be signed up on a salary with a 401k and everything before you start providing value. Just provide value to people and it'll like come back to you in spades.
Because I did this when I was doing business development. One of the accounts we wanted was Verizon. So Verizon sells phone, TV, and internet service. The agency, we're working for the agency, went on the website. It was confusing to pick the packages. There was like 50 different options. They were using all sorts of technical jargon. And we had an idea to make it easier for people to understand. Our hypothesis was, if people understood it and could make selections easier, they'd increase conversion rates. We didn't ask about it. We didn't pitch it. We just mocked it up. And we said, here's our hypothesis. Here's why. We made a little video audit and sent it to some high level ups over at Verizon. And we did this at Geico as well. Within, I don't know, a day or two, we got responses, because to your point, Alex, we got started. We didn't talk about it. We showed it. And I think when you show people things they haven't thought of yet, that's the other key to this. It can't be something someone already knows. If it's a new perspective or a new idea or a new take, that's like dangling candy in front of a baby, man. And again, to your point, Alex, it's a super good one. The best part about this is you're not waiting for someone else to read your letter and cover a resume. You can actually get started on these things that Alex is talking about today without having to wait for anyone. Fantastic.
Yeah. So that's basically it. So now I've got the podcast. It allows me to speak with interesting people, and it's a great get your foot in the door tool with someone I want to meet. But then I've also got the fintech startup, where we've essentially built a bank for a few $100,000. I mean, it's crazy how fast it's growing now and how much people are liking it. But
tell us, back up a little bit. What's the problem? Well, let me ask you the question, because I ask everyone this. It's always a fun little question. What does Pay Club do?
Yep. So we're building the Gen Z bank. What does that mean? I mean, who's Gen Z and why do they need a bank? Gen Z is people that are born in the late 90s to the mid 2000s. People that grew up in the middle of the financial crisis, and they interact with finance very differently from any other generation. And you look at how they're getting bank accounts and credit cards, they're just not. And that's like the core feature of finance. You know, Chase or Wells Fargo knows that if they get you on a checking account, that they're going to have you for the next 17 years, and you're going to spend lots of money, and they're going to get you on credit cards and debit cards and auto loans and everything else. But if you don't get a checking account, because Gen Z uses Venmo as their checking account or their parents' account, and they don't want credit, then how does the system get you? So how do we get those users? Well, we solve the problem of collecting money with a group. And when you think about the way that a college student spends their money, 85% of it is in some type of group dynamic with friends and roommates and clubs and organizations on trips, whatever it is. And if you take the roommate example, you have four roommates, and you never really know if your roommate paid the utility bill or the Netflix bill or even rent. Now you have a charge, say, hey, we've got a $50 utility bill. Everyone kick in $10. Now everyone in the group can see who kicked in the $10 and now where that money went to. So there's transparency, which is like one of the things that this generation really, really cares deeply about. And when you extrapolate that to a club on a college campus called a fraternity, we're at a bunch of fraternities at UCLA right now. I mean, a few other schools. Some of these fraternities are collecting upwards of $1 million. and they have a volunteer, the treasurer, the president, whoever it is, collecting sometimes on a weekly basis, sometimes monthly, quarterly, whatever it is, with Venmo and Excel, basically. Sometimes they have a club management platform, but they're collecting from hundreds and hundreds of people on their personal Venmo account and keeping track of everything in Excel. So when we tell that person, that guy, that gal, hey, like, we're going to make your life a lot simpler. You can create a group, add everyone to it, and there's transparency for everyone to see who's paid, who hasn't paid. That person's eyes light up and they're like, oh my God, I spend 4 hours a week reconciling my bank account and my Venmo account of who's paid. And so we make that problem. We solve that problem of collecting money of the group really, really simply.
Yeah, guys, so listen to this, because we talk about this on pretty much every podcast when I ask people what they do, and oftentimes they don't say what Alex said. They talk about their thing, and they don't talk about what I call the infomercial, which is what Alex did, right? What's the before? What's all the stuff they're doing? All the, in Yiddish words, mishigas. What are the 50 steps? It's Excel. I got to figure out what it is. There's accountability. Who paid what? I got to go nagging people. My hair's on fire. It's awful. And then the after of the infomercial is that goes away. I mean, it's like the car cane, right? Struggling to get out of the car, your knees hurt, have to push off, need someone to help you out. That's the problem. The after, use the car cane and get out of the car by yourself effortlessly. So Alex, how did you see this problem? Where did it germinate from? Was the founder experiencing this problem firsthand?
Yeah, so we've got a unique, my co-founder, our CEO, his name's Jason. He's our secret sauce. As you say, you know, why, like people that when you're raising money for a startup, they say, you know, okay, I get the problem. Now, why you? Why is it going to be you that's going to solve this problem? And his background before this company, he had two jobs. The first run out of college, he was what's called a fraternity consultant. So he traveled around the country for this fraternity, Alpha Epsilon Pi, and he slept on fraternity couches, and he like told fraternities how to like, every fraternity is essentially a little business. So he trained.
What a job. How did I not think of being a fraternity consultant? What a job. You just go around and having fraternity parties? Is that a real job?
Basically, I mean, he slept on fraternity couches for 2 years.
God, that's only second to be, that might be the best job I've ever heard. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you gotta have the right personality. But he certainly did. And so then his next one was he started what turned into now the largest college travel company in the country. So they sell trips, like spring break trips and music festival trips and winter ski trips and Cabo spring break, Las Vegas music festival, all those sorts of things. And now that company, it was just acquired, but they travel like 500,000 kids like every year, like tons and tons of kids. And as he was planning these parties and elaborate transfers, and people are going to take a bus to here and then get on a plane and then have 50 different hotel rooms, he saw how people were collecting for that. And it was just a nightmare of different people collecting from 10 people and moving the money from different bank accounts. And he was like, wow, it's just like a nightmare. There's got to be a better way. And so it's funny because he's, you know, now he's my age. We're both 32. He's 10 years removed from college, but he's been involved in the college ecosystem for those 10 years. So we're so connected to the users that we were even able to, you know, craft, develop a solution basically in partnership with tons and tons of college students and club leaders that solves a major pain point for them.
Yeah. So guys, if you're listening to this again, this is a recurring theme. Rather than thinking about what can I create, take a look at where you're working, what you're doing, and figure out how you can eliminate steps. Take a look at struggles, right? What are people struggling with? What is this process that's really cumbersome? And is there a better way? No better way to do that than when you're in it. And hey, if you could be a fraternity consultant, which I've never heard of before, that's awesome too. Alex, you have said it all, my friend. I knew this episode would not disappoint. If people want to learn more about you, connect with you, talk with you, what's the best way?
Yeah, so I'd love for you to check out my podcast. Similar kind of stuff. We talk about the ups and downs of really important people's careers and lives. It's called Moving Up. It's everywhere people find podcasts. And you know, I'm on Twitter, A. Grodnik, Grodnik. And that'd be great.
Alex, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Pure gold, my friend. Thanks for dropping so many knowledge bombs.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks for having me on here. And really a lot of fun.